This documentary, From Ennis to Nashville, has been funded by Commission Na Mban with the television license fee.
One bright blue rose outlives all those 2,000 years, and still it grows to ponder his death and his life eternally.
She can sing a song like no other. She has performed in front of thousands of people in some of the best concert venues in the world. She is Maura O'Connell. Welcome to our tribute documentary, From Ennis to Nashville.
Watching the long faces riding this run-down track in the lost places, from a dream that never brings them back. And the sad truth is nothing but a cold.
Maura enjoyed a happy childhood in Ennis, where her family, the O'Connells, lived on Upper Market Street.
Well, of course, my grandma, Nana, lived with us, and my uncle Frank, and my dad, and my three sisters and I lived in the house, and it was always very lively. The earliest memories I have of singing is, you know, if it was raining outside when we couldn't play, the record player would be on, and we'd be all singing along to musicals and dancing around the table and dancing, you know. My dad and my mum would dance with us, and we would learn how to do different steps just for fun. Like, one of my earliest memories is of being, there was a skylight in the hall, and I was probably 3 or 4, and my mother had her hand on my stomach and the other end to my back, and she was giving me, she wasn't saying anything, but making sure that I was singing from my stomach as opposed to from my head. Because she was a marvelous singer herself and sang in all the musical societies. And she had 6 brothers and a much older sister. She could have gone and studied opera in Europe on a scholarship, but my grandmother needed her to help with everything. But she was always so nervous of me when I took up singing professionally, because I was supposed to take over the shop. But going back to earlier memories, I remember we always sang, and we always, as when my, whatever opera my mother was in the musical society, we always knew all the songs, and we all had a party piece. And I thought every house was like that growing up. And my father was, he acted a little bit. So there was always a bit of acting and singing and whatever going on, and recitations. And
They used to call the musicals years ago the operas, but they weren't operas, they were musicals, you know. So Mum would have taught us those kind of songs. And then on a completely opposite end of the scale, then my father would be teaching us rebel songs.
My mother used to hide his records. And she liked, you know, we had My Fair Lady and Gigi and, you know, and then as kids we had the little 45s that had all the Disney songs and all the, you know, all the things like that. So we, you know, we were surrounded by music, really.
So that was kind of the original sort of influence. And then I suppose in early teens we'd be listening to what was on the radio, and then things got a bit more progressive. It was Bob Dylan and sort of folk music.
That was Anya, the youngest member of the family. Both Maura and Anya have vivid memories of their beloved family business, Costello's Fish Shop.
We all took a turn working there. We had no choice. When you were told you were going to work, and you worked, it was grand. You know, you'd have known everyone in town, and there was always a bit of banter and a bit of crack going on. And in fact, originally Maura was meant to kind of take over the business. That was the original plan, kind of earmarked to take. And that was what she was going to do, I think, at one stage.
But I always went down to the shop. I had a Saturday job washing the trays and I got 6 pence or something for it. And I started working behind the counter when I was very young. And after I finished secondary school, I kind of thought, and she wanted me to go and do accounting, and I had gotten enough honours to do it, but I kept putting off the application.
Another Ennis native who worked in a store near Costello's Fish Shop, just a stone's throw away, was Mike Hanrahan.
As a teenager, I worked in Morgan McInerney's shop, which was across the road from her mum's fish shop in the market. I worked there, so I used to see her every day. She'd be cleaning down with her she was all togged out for because they hosed down the shop every evening. I was across the road, dusting, doing nothing in the hardware shop. And then we kind of knew each other from then. I knew her from singing at church.
Before Mike and Maura united musically, she was invited to attend a concert headlined by Emmylou Harris. she ultimately decided not to go.
Friends of mine went up to see Emmylou Harris in Dublin, and I said, I'm not going to see anybody called Emmylou anything because I hate country music. And they came back with her LP, and I heard it was called Porter Moon in a 10-cent town. Blew my mind. I couldn't believe that that was country music, but it was like alternative country music at the time. I'd heard Bonnie Raitt and that sort of thing, so I decided I had an old guitar that was in the house for forever, probably had never had its strings changed, and I decided they had open mics out in Joe Galligan's folk club out in Crashee. So I decided I'd go out and do a couple of songs out there. Frightened out of my life, of course. And TV Honan happened to be there. And I think he said, maybe she should meet Mike Henry.
Tumbleweed was formed around 77, I'd say. I'd been actually playing sessions with Stockton's Ring at the time. I wasn't in the band. And then myself, Maura, hooked up at some, I think there's one, we sang it somewhere together in when Stockton's Ring were there doing a session. So we decided then to kind of get together, and TV had an apartment on the top floor down in Abbey Street. And we went down there and we learned songs and chatted about music. And we actually, I think we did probably play there maybe five or six nights a week. We'd meet down there. There was myself and TV and Maura and Paddy O'Brien, our friend Paddy.
When we would learn a song that we were going to perform, I'd never let him hear the song. I'd only sing it for him so that he wouldn't copy. Not that he would do it intentionally, but that I'd say, no, I don't like that chord. That doesn't sound. I don't like that chord. I like that chord, you know, and we'll do it this way, you know. So I was learning myself as I was going along. So it was a great apprenticeship, really.
We were very blessed to have Joe Galligan's folk club out in Crashee, the highway inn. Joe used to bring bands out there, and you see all sorts of bands you wouldn't get to see anywhere. They were doing the circuit. There was a great folk club circuit around Ireland, which was actually set up by Joe. And it meant that touring artists could come into Ireland for a 2-week period and probably work 10 of those nights together around Ireland, because folk clubs were like, could be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I think, in fact, I don't think there was any folk club on Saturday nights because bigger gigs took over. So Joe had set up this, it was called the Fania, the ring, and it was the ring of folk clubs. So we got to see all these bands. Like, I remember a young Barry Moore was out there. Hobo Junction were a great band at the time, Midnight Well. So we got a few gigs out there as support artists. And Joe really believed in what we were doing. And we had no idea what we were doing as young artists. We were very green. And I remember somewhere, I think we did an amazing gig down with Bobby Clancy from the Clancy Brothers. Nobody turned up for our concert on their folk club, and we decided to move upstairs to the bar. He had a hotel there. And we sang, and then Bobby said something like to Maura, just, he said, you have a beautiful, so beautiful voice. He says, but is there any chance you'll open your eyes and look up at the crowd?
But I was still very shy on the stage even. I would always close my eyes so I wouldn't have to see the audience, and was forever banging my mouth into the microphone, which was how I didn't break my teeth is beyond me.
And there was all these kind of things we were learning, because we were complete greenhorns. But we had this great connection through our music, and we were great friends, and we've remained great friends ever since. It's really special.
Producer PJ Curtis had a significant influence on Mike's and Maura's career. He remembers hearing Maura sing for the first time and was captivated by her voice.
I'd moved back to Clare from Dublin, where I had worked with Mulligan, and I had moved back to Clare, living in Kilnaboy in a small cottage. And I went into Cora Finn one night, and I heard this voice coming from a side room in the pub in Cora Finn. I thought, is that a recording? And it turned out to be this young girl sitting there, eyes closed, singing a song. And I thought, wow, this girl has a big voice. And I said, who is that? And then somebody told me that's Maura O'Connell, because the second time I saw her was them playing together as Tumbleweed on Stephen's Day in Ennis.
I went to musical college, I suppose, with PJ when he lived up in Kilnaboy. We'd go up once a week and he'd play all these magnificent recordings. What an education. I don't think you could get it in a college.
Following Tumbleweed's success, Mike joined Stockton's Wing, while Maura returned to work at the fish shop. However, one night she ended up singing a couple of songs and caught the ear of Frankie Gavin from Dedannan.
I first came across Maura in the early 80s, I do believe, and it was in a little hotel in County Clare, and she was doing a going away party for some friends in the back room. Myself and a friend of mine were out in the front bar, and I was listening to this voice, and I asked the owner of the hotel, could I go in and get a closer look and a listen? And he said, I'm sure that'll be okay. So that's where we met, and that's a long time ago, early 80s, I suppose. And at the time, we had gone through one or two singers. Well, of course, Dolores had just left, and Johnny Moynihan joined us for a while, and it was kind of, singers were kind of coming and going a bit, but when I heard Maura's voice, I thought, yep, this is a serious voice and worth considering, and I'll give her a shout and see. There was this great sense of discovery once I came across Maura at that time, yeah.
Frankie called on a Friday. The shop used to be very, very busy on Fridays, and my mother said to me, whoever is on that phone call, tell him to phone you back because it's very busy. So I said, I can't talk now, and call later on when it's not so busy. So he did. And he asked me, would I go to America for 6 weeks? And I said, well, I don't really know many traditional songs. You know, I mean, it wasn't like I was against them or anything, but I didn't grow up like maybe Dolores or Mary with like a history and a way to get or how to find songs. It wasn't something I knew much about. And I said, well, I don't really know very many songs that would suit. And she said, well, he said, we'll sing whatever, you know. First of all, I said no. And then I said, call me back in a week and we'll think about it. So I talked to Mam and I said, what do you think? And she said, well, sure, you'll get to see America for 6 weeks.
Favourite song of Maura's that I would say that I, well, of course, the one we had the biggest hit with was My Irish Molly. Still people young and old, from children to pensioners and older, know this song inside out and back to front. It's still a hot favourite, and she's the only one that can really sing it.
Our first kind of a practice gig we did was in the old Druid Theatre in Galway. I met somebody recently who was at that gig, and that would have been in October of 1980. But Molly was beyond the charts in terms of success. I mean, it was huge. And I can see, you know, the appeal of it. It's jolly, it's, you know, all that. But it's very sexist. I sang it at the St. Patrick's Day Parade, because when Pat Daly contacted me, he was singing it at me, and he said, will you sing it? And I said, oh, okay.
Maura O'Connell had become the lead singer of Daidanin at this point. Another key figure in her career was Maurice Cassidy, who would go on to become her manager.
I would have come to know Maura O'Connell when she was the singer with Daidanin, and the representative manager, whatever you're called, they're called now for the band, was Ollie Jennings. So I noticed My Irish Molly, and somehow, way or other, I came to own the album. Maura was the singer with the band, and she did a fantastic job. Fabulous band. And some way or other, her and myself and PJ Curtis would have hooked up.
After 2 years, Maura felt it was the appropriate moment to part ways with Daidanin and embark on a solo career.
The musical guest to open the show tonight. Earlier this year, we featured her, and she was just setting out on a solo career, having sung successfully with various folk groups down through the years. Since then, her first album was recorded, and this has given rise to no less than three singles, hit singles from that LP. Ladies and gentlemen, let's have a welcome for Maura O'Connell.
After TV appearances and recordings, Maura crossed paths with the talented singer-songwriter Charlie McGettigan.
Well, there was a little folk club down here in the Bush Hotel in Carrick and Shannon called the Colliers Folk Club. And they would bring, you know, visiting artists, people. They even had Béla Fleck and Jerry Douglas. Maura was one of the guests. I would just happen to be in the folk club the night they were there, and I was knocked out by Maura's singing, you know. I said, wow, I'd never heard of her before. And at this stage, I said, I would love that girl to sing one of my songs, you know. So I brought along this song that I'd written called Let Me Know About It on a cassette in those days. And the whole trick to get singers to listen to your song is to bring a little Walkman with you. So I brought a little tape recorder with me so that she could listen to it, and I knew she'd heard it, you know. And of course, Maura's a very feisty girl, you know, and doesn't suffer fools easily, you know. So I was kind of surprised when she agreed to listen to it, you know, and so she listened and she liked it. And I had put the song, I think, into a song contest in Cavan. There was this thing called the Cavan Song Contest, quite a big contest, you know. And I boldly asked her, would you be interested in singing the song for me at the song contest? Oh, yeah, why wouldn't I? She said, you know, and she did. And we got to know each other then.
In the 80s, Maura's manager reached out to PJ Curtis, who was then working as a producer in Nashville. Following this call, PJ was excited to welcome Maura to the United States.
Maura rang me and he said, you know Maura O'Connell, don't you? And I said, absolutely, I know her. He said, well, I've just signed her. And he said, and I want you to produce her. And I said, I'd be absolutely delighted. But, he said, what's the but? I said, but I'm in Nashville and I've got no intention of coming home anytime soon until my visa runs out. And he said, well, if you can't do it here, we'll bring her there. So I said, fantastic. I went back to Philip. I said, Philip, I've got this singer in Ireland. I want to bring her out. She is great. And what do we do? So Philip said, OK, he said, I will line up the musicians. So Philip became my MD, as it were, on the session. And he lined up the A-team. Maura arrived out. She got off the plane in sometime, I think it was the 2nd or 3rd of January, and we were in a studio 5 days later. And I knew like what she was capable of doing. That was the big thing. She was the same standing in front of a microphone in Nashville as she is today. That voice was there. And so she arrived out. We spent 2 days, I think, in the house with Philip. And I have photographs of us all around the table and taking notes and what songs and all the rest of it. And I was going into the publishing houses. And I had met Roger Cook, that had been a serious player, a serious songwriter in England as well as in Nashville. He had his own publishing company. And you go around to these houses, they put you into a room, you listen to songs, and you think, OK, that might suit Maura, you know, and you choose maybe a couple of songs. So I came away with songs. She had her own songs. And by the time we sat around the table, we had kind of worked out more or less what we were going to work on.
PJ Curtis played a crucial role in helping Maura become a part of the Nashville music scene. He also introduced her to Jim Rooney, who worked with Nancy Griffith, Hal Ketchum, and John Prine.
I met her with PJ. I just thought she was fantastic right away. She has a presence even then. I mean, how many years ago was this? We're talking about 40 years ago. She was a young woman. But she was very confident of herself and held herself that way. And PJ introduced her to a lot of very good top musicians in Nashville. Philip Donnelly, of course, was there, and she knew Philip. But otherwise, she didn't know anybody else, as far as I know. That could be intimidating for some people, but she wasn't intimidated by it at all. I think she was quite excited by it. And happy to be in the midst of some good players and some also songwriters like Roger Cook. She met Roger and they recorded Living in These Troubled Times, which of course turned out to be a very important song for Maura. But she had a presence about her right from the first time I met her, and I liked her instantly. She has a great laugh, and she seemed to be quite comfortable with herself and with us. And she met Bela Fleck at those sessions and Jerry Douglas at those sessions, and they became lifelong friends.
Maura's musical connection with Bela Fleck began when he was part of the group New Grass Revival. In Bela's career, he has won 17 Grammy Awards. He heard Maura sing in Louisville, Kentucky, sparking a lasting friendship.
We all fell for her. Everyone said she was the best singer they'd ever heard. And we'd never really heard anything like it, you know, at that level. She sang with so much soul, and she was super, super cute, and she was funny. Yeah, she just stole the show. It was awesome. And she always had a way of sort of stumbling or doing something, you know, awkward that made the audience love her so much. You know, she was just a real person up there. But again, the singing was a knockout. She came to Nashville to make a record with PJ Curtis producing, and a fabulous band of musicians that that he put together. And I got to be around for that. And it was another, she was a knockout again. She did a great job. That was her first album. And I do remember the awkward part was a lot of fun because she had a drink and she knocked it into the console at the recording studio, which, as you can imagine, was incredibly upsetting to the studio guy. I think it was a guy named Chip who had the place at the time. Yeah, they had to take the console apart and clean every wire, and the session stopped. Everybody loved her so much, nobody was like mad at her or anything. If it had been me, I would have never played another session. I would go to Ireland, and I got to know her people, her manager, her family. I would spend sometimes a month in Ennis at the end of the year there for several years, and spent time with her in Dublin. And it was a really special time, I think, for both of us. At some point, it came up the idea that I might produce a record for her, and her manager thought it was a good idea. She thought it was a good idea, and we went for it, you know, when she came to Nashville. And we made that record with the best people I could find.
One of the musicians present was the renowned Jerry Douglas, a musician who has played on over 1,000 albums and collaborated with artists such as Garth Brooks, Paul Simon, and James Taylor. He recalls his initial meeting with Maura.
She was just out at Dandenong at the time, so that I met her. So she was wild. She had, you know, her hair was multicolored. She was very European and very flashy, very, very sure of herself. And I loved her immediately. You know, we just kind of locked up immediately. It was a good thing. It was a good day, the day I met Maura O'Connell. Yeah, I've worked with her since, you know, since day one. I was on that record that she came over here to do, and then she moved over here. We all lived on the same street in west part of Nashville for a couple of years. And then she struck out on her own, and Russ Barenberg and I played live with her on the gigs that she would get over here, and she would take off, and we would go with her and play on all these shows. And she introduced me to Celtic music in a lot of ways, and just, you know, she's Irish, so she brought all of that with her. I guess sort of educated myself on Irish music to stay with her, you know, to stay in the same column with her. And you know, she trusted me over the years to produce a couple of records for her. But, you know, we've just been such good friends, you know, since we met, that it was just, it's been one of those things where anything she wanted me to do, I was willing to go ahead musically and try to take care of all those needs. She just is a wonderful singer. She's a singer's singer. You know, she is always in tune. You don't have to tune Maura O'Connell. She's a natural, very natural singer, and those are few and far between.
In the studio, well, I mean, she's a great live singer. So, you know, someone who's as great a natural singer as her doesn't love doing lots and lots of takes. And an instrumentalist like myself, who's really picky about, you know, technique and stuff like that, and I want more takes. So we had, a very natural difference of opinion sometimes about that. Maybe she was, what was wrong with what we just did? You know, and I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe we'll get a better one. If we get a better one, we'll use that one. You know, it was that kind of dialogue seemed to happen a lot. But we ended up both very satisfied with the project. You know, however we got there, it was all very exciting at the time, you know.
The few memories I have in there are all great. When Maura came in then to put on her main vocals, she's inside the microphone, eyes closed, and she's delivering this great take. And I'm aware of a guy coming into the studio behind me. Then I was aware of him coming out of the office with something under his arm, a tape as it turned out to be. And he stood and he was listening to Maura through the glass. And he said, "Holy sh! Who is that dame?" And the engineer, Glenn, said to him, "Oh, that's an Irish singer we're working with, Mara O'Connell." And he said, "Wow, that dame sure can sing." And he marched out. And I said to Glenn, I said, who was that? He said, did you not recognise him? He said, that's Dr. Hook. And so there you've got a major player in a major band standing, listening to maybe a couple of bars of Mara, and knew that she was delivering the goodies.
They were just coming to the end of one of the recording sessions. I had sent PJ a copy of a song called I Don't Know How You Do It, which was a kind of a ragtimey, bluesy kind of a thing. And they were coming to the end of the session in Nashville. They had half an hour to spare. And PJ said, like, you should try this one. This one, you might like this song, Charlie McGettigan's song. And she did the whole thing in half an hour. And it ended up on the album. And it's a fantastic version. I often take it out and listen to it here, on her very first album.
And it was the first Charlie McGettigan song ever recorded by anybody. Because I had worked with Charlie prior to that. And I knew him to be a great singer-songwriter. So we had the song called I Don't Know How You Do It. And we were about to start the session. And halfway through the session, I was aware of a lot of people coming into the studio, and somebody said to me, this is Lynn Anderson and her team. So, and they were waiting to get in. And so I said, oh, and so I knew there was a bit of pressure on me to end our session. So I went in to the guys. I said, guys, there's a gang out there waiting to replace us. We've overrun our time. We have to do it in one. They all sat around, and I think even Mara herself did the take in one take. In one take, and we were out of there, and they were all sitting inside listening to her, and there was comments made like, wow, that's an Irish singer, wow, she's really great, you know, and because they recognise another great singer.
Following the success of her debut album, Mora set her sights on releasing her second album.
And then in 86, we did Just In Time. Of course, Morris had never heard of Bailen Bailen, hadn't become the big success he is now. I think we did six songs and sent them to him, and he said we could finish the record. And that was Just In Time. And that was Jerry Douglas and all the big cats now, as they call them, Bela and Jerry and Mark O'Connor and Edgar Meyer. And we just played the songs. We just loved the music. And they were never confined to any genres, which I really liked, you know, because I picked songs from everywhere. Because, you know, when I'd be asking interviews, well, what kind of songs do you sing? And I'd say, well, good ones. You know, I don't have any kind of definitive. I'll only sing this kind of song. That's not the kind of singer I am. And then eventually I got to know more songwriters.
You know, I was just looking at a record here. I have it in front of me called Stories. And there are songs on there by the Irish writers as well as the Nashville writers. And she really paid attention to songs. Some singers will just sing whatever's put in front of them. She wasn't like that. She had to believe in the song, I think, to sing it.
Being a solo performer and trying to find material, I used to find Jimmy McCarthy on this. When I lived in Dublin for a while, I'd find Jimmy and he'd be walking up the street and I'd bring him home and I'd make him sing into a tape machine for me. And then, of course, I'd pour through all my records and find songs that weren't very well known.
Charlie McGettigan and Mora had been friends for years, with Mora even recording some of Charlie's songs. But at the time, she was looking for a new song to record.
At one point, she came down to the house.
And I was looking for songs and he was playing me this, that and the other. And I said, give me the book.
And she found this song called Feet of a Dancer. It was just on a sheet of written, handwritten.
And he said, oh, I just wrote that for the kids. I said, play it for me.
And what does this one go like? And I sort of looked at it, conscious I couldn't remember what it went like. And eventually I think I made a melody up on the spot to go with the words.
Because it was personal, you know, and I think that's what made it so good, because he had written it for his children.
Thanks be to God she did, because it was one of the most successful songs of my songs ever.
The gigs and recording continued at pace. She then released another album, titled Western Highway.
That was the record that was nominated for a Grammy. It was called Western Highway when it came out here, which is a song by Jerry O'Byrne. When I was looking for songs, I called Jerry, and he sent me Western Highway, and I immediately fell in love with it. And have been, I think any gig I've done in the years since I recorded it, I've done it at every gig.
I really like Western Highway. That's a really special track. I remember Russ Barenberg was a guitarist on it. We came up with a double guitar arrangement to sort of take the place of the 12-string guitar that the song was written with. On that one, we went further into a pop direction. You know, we used drums more, quite a bit more, and we kind of mixed, I don't know, now you might call it Americana, but we mixed some, you know, just really good songs with, you know, we had electric bass more often, we had more different kinds of instruments on different tracks. I remember it was like a holiday, and we were at Russ's house having dinner, and I brought my guitar, and he had his guitar, and he and I just kept sitting in the corner working on this piece, and she was like, would you stop that and have dinner? And we're like, no, we're going in the studio tomorrow. We want to really get something special for you. And she would like, well, stop it. You know, and it was that kind of thing. And the song is gorgeous, and she sang it great, and it really puts you in a place.
Bela and Jerry and all those guys then had started to become much more well known, and there was a little window open, and they had all made records, and it was because of my association with them, I think, that I was signed by Warner Brothers.
During this part of her journey, Maura was preparing to finalize a record deal with Warner Brothers when she crossed paths with Ronna Rubin.
Because there's one thing that came out of our initial meeting that is still a punchline between the two of us all these years later. It was 1988, she had just been signed to Warner Brothers Nashville. At that time, the Nashville division of Warner Brothers was really straight on country music. They were releasing country music albums. But there were artists at other labels and kind of just in our world, like Cheryl Wheeler, Nancy Griffith, Bela Fleck, that were making records, and some of them were also based out of Nashville labels. And so the head of the label at the time was willing and open-minded enough to say, yeah, we can look beyond just country music. Right after she was signed, we organized a casual lunch gathering with the publicity department in Maura at a restaurant in Nashville. And it was just kind of, let's get to know each other. And immediately you could tell she was really funny and really engaging. But the funniest memory from that luncheon was when she clearly said that she had no interest in being famous. And so I laughed and simply said, well, you've just made my job a whole lot easier. But I knew at that point that we were going to be good friends.
In the late 1980s, RTE created an 8-part series titled She's Got It, which was produced by Moya Doherty. As Maura was getting ready to host one of the episodes, she received an unexpected call from her sister.
On the Sunday morning of when I was supposed to go in to sing it, I got to the desk at RTE, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and they said, there's a phone call for you. And I thought that was very strange, because no cell phones then, of course. And so I took the call, and it was my sister, and she said, ma'am, sick, you're going to have to come home. I said, I can't, I'm doing a TV show. And then she said, she's dead, because she had died of a heart attack suddenly. And I have to say, RTE were wonderful to me. I had a car that I was going to drive down. They wouldn't let me drive down. And Mike Hanrahan came with me. He was one of my guests. And everyone was wonderful. Mike came with me. And they had this ancient limousine that they used to use for the Late Late Show. And it broke down in Monster Heaven. And I think it might have. And it, of course, it was October, in the late October. And it was raining and miserable. And Mike hitchhiked into Monster Heaven on a Sunday to find a mechanic who could come out and work on the car. So that, you know, so there's amusement among the tragedy. I don't care who you are, your mother is your mother, and she was she was the ruler of the roost, really. She did everything, and she was so kind to so many, many people, as was my grandmother. I learned an awful lot from her. She was never walked. She nearly always ran, and she ran up and down. And did, she was in the parish council. She helped so many people. You know, I'd go away somewhere and I'd come back and half my clothes would be missing. She said, I declined for that. Somebody needed that. You know, that sort of thing.
In their time of mourning, the O'Connell family found solace in a song that Maura sang, as Áine and Maura reminisce.
The hand is cold that once held mine. I can't believe
about somebody passing away, and it's time to learn to let them go. And it is a very difficult song. I think she's recorded it more than sang it in concert. Some songs are very difficult to not to get totally emotionally involved in. And that's what she does, like, she embodies the song. You know, she doesn't just sing it, she lives it.
I can remember the first time I heard it. The world famous station in, but it's called The Home of Bluegrass, you know. Just my heart broke. And then every time he would do, or we were ever somewhere and he was doing a gig, I'd say, we would sing Time to Learn. And he says, but it makes you cry. And I said, but that's okay, that's good, I need it, you know. But when we recorded it, it was Edgar and Jerry and Russ and I, the old group, and we recorded it in one take, and we didn't say a word for, I'd say, 3 minutes after it, silently in the booths. Nobody said a word. But I knew it was going to upset my sisters. So when I was home that summer, I went to each of them and played it. And I said, this is going to be on the record. It was also very hard for them to hear because her death was so sudden and the lyric is so poignant.
I happened to publish that. I had a publishing company at the time, and Tim and Pat were writing songs for us. And I had heard the song, and then when I heard Maura sing it, it just moved me to tears. It still moves me to tears every time I hear her sing it.
I never had a chance to say goodbye to you.
For many years, Maura and Mary Black have been good friends. Mary was aware of her talents long before they crossed paths. She vividly remembers their first conversation.
I knew of Maura before I met her. And I remember we were going down to, I was playing a few solo gigs with Declan Sinnott and Jimmy McCarthy. And Jimmy was singing a few of his own songs before the show, and then we did a few together, and Maura was at the gig, and she was really, really, that's the first time I actually think I met her properly. We had talked on the phone. The first time I spoke to Maura, she rang me after she had decided to leave Daydanan, and Daydanan had approached me to see would I be interested, and I was actually very interested because I had been gigging a bit as a solo artist, but then it was great to be in a band like Daydanan, who had a following in America and at festivals all over Europe and stuff. So it was a great opportunity for me. Maura was leaving the band, but she gave me a call out of the blue, and she said to me, wishing me all the best. And she just said to me, I just want to give you one piece of advice. The advice was, she said to me, just don't take any shit. And she might not realize it now, but like, honestly, I've taken that what she said to me to heart, and I have lived my life with that little voice in my head saying.
After departing Daydanan to pursue her solo career, Mary assembled a full band to accompany her performances. One of the vocalists who joined her during this period was Eleanor McAvoy. During this time, Eleanor penned many songs. One particular song would go on to become one of the best-selling hits of the 90s, titled A Woman's Heart.
One night I was doing a gig of my own music, and she came along to the gig and she heard me sing this song, A Woman's Heart. And her husband had an idea to put together a compilation album of Irish women. And they approached me the next day and said, look, how would you feel about Mary duetting with you on that song? Because whilst you're known a little bit in Dublin, nobody really knows you outside of Dublin. And with Mary on it, it would get airplay and stuff. And I thought, God, it'd be fantastic. I'd be delighted because, you know, as well as playing in her band, I guess I was a fan of hers too. And I remember Joe popping into the studio just as we were finishing, and he listened to it and he said, God, he said, you know, this could sell like 3,000 copies.
A compilation album was released alongside this single, featuring powerful Irish female artists Dolores Keane, Frances Black, Mary Black, and Maura O'Connell. This album was a significant moment in Ireland, empowering women in the music industry.
Times were really, really changing in Ireland. And of course, the Tiger was just around the corner. And then because it just gave this voice to women who'd really not had much of a voice before, gave women strength, or showed their strength, I suppose, even if it was just in song. When it first came out, I just thought, there it is out now. And, you know, and then I got a call, would I come to Dublin for the Platinum record? And I said, of course. And sure, they flew me over, and I said, grand. And I was walking up Grafton Street, and I saw people looking at me and pointing at me, and I got awful nervous. I actually had an anxiety attack. And I had, because I had no idea that it had become how big, because I wasn't here. Because it was on the radio all the time, and, you know, and then the next thing, it was the biggest selling album of all time in Ireland. And we toured, oh man, we had such fun. And everywhere we went, again, which is another sign, oh, bunch of women, are you always fighting? They would ask the crew, are they awful? Are they shouting at one another? And we laughed our hearts out.
But it was lovely to tour with the girls. And I did a big, big tour of America, and we did a tour of the UK as well. Yeah, it was a great time for women in music. And it kind of like we were really sort of, you know, making our presence felt.
Months passed after the album release, and Maura had a memorable day ahead as she prepared to marry Mac Bennett. They first met at The Coop, a bar tucked away in a restaurant in Nashville. Maura returned home to tie the knot.
And we started dating, and we decided we would buy a house. And my father was visiting at the time. And I said we'd show him the house. We hadn't purchased it yet, but anyway, he said to me, are you getting married? I said, sure, we might someday. I mean, it wasn't in my head. We might, sure. Just to give him, you know, so he would be all right, you know. And the next thing, I got a phone call from my sister Aileen. She said, the old ground and the church are available on the 3rd of April, the 27th of March, and the blah, blah, blah. Which date do you want? And I nearly had a heart attack. And I said to Meg, this is going on. What are we going to do? What am I going to say to her? And he said, well, shouldn't we get married? So that was it. That's how we got married. A load of people came from the States. Mac is from Arkansas, and friends came from Nashville and Arkansas, and they'd never seen anything like an Irish wedding. They had great crack. They had a huge time, and so did we. And it was really fun, you know, to do it in the Irish style.
3 years after Maura and Mac got married, their son, Jesse, was born.
Jesse came along in 96. And he was 6 weeks early. I was worried about movement, and I called my doctor, and she put me in for the scan, and they said everything was fine and that everything was going great and not to worry. Then that Sunday I was trying to move him and I couldn't feel any movement. I called Anne again. I said, Anne, there's something not right. And she said, I'll meet you at the hospital. So I went, and they put me on this monitor overnight, and then they gave me a C-section in the morning. But we noticed that he wasn't sitting up and, we, you know, easily by himself. And we eventually, after 14 months, we got the diagnosis of cerebral palsy. Yeah. But he's brilliant, almost genius level clever. We did everything we could. We brought him to some PT and OT that they had organized. But the doctor basically said that's just for the parents, not the children, you know. And we went to a place called the Rehabilitation Center in Chicago that is related to a Northwestern. They cover everything, PT, OT, and so we went to them every 6 months. And we also went to Hungary to the Peto Institute there, and they had started that specifically for cerebral palsy when they were Dr. Peto had started the institute. And we got a lot of help there. And then we had a couple of the Peto people come to America to help with Jesse. He's in a chair now, but he's gone to college and he's got his degree. He's huge into politics. He knows more about Irish politics than Irish people do. His degree is in political science and history.
Maura possesses a distinctive voice that distinguishes her from other singers. But it is her commanding stage presence that truly sets her apart.
She really does have a great stage presence, and that's something that you just, not everybody has, you know, not just the voice, it's just how she interacts with the audience and how she can make them laugh and engage them. You know, once she has an audience in front of her, and she was a shy girl when she was young, but she seems to come alive on stage for some reason. You know, she was quite shy in her teens, but she just came into herself on stage. And she does have a great stage craft. I suppose that comes with experience as well. But when I would be on stage with her, I'd just stand back and let her off, like, and just sing.
America entertainment is different to what we have here. It's a lot of razzmatazz about it. There's a lot of attention to presence on stage. There's confidence. And Maura acquired this amazing confidence on stage. When you consider back when Bobby, Clancy was telling her, open your eyes. Suddenly, Maura came back from America. Her eyes were open. Her movement on stage, she has this most beautiful, graceful presence on stage. And the way she holds the microphone, the way she connects with the band around her, connects with her audience. She got that from America. That taught her that, and it brought out that personality that myself and TV knew back in the days in Tumbleweed, where we had lots of fun in the quiet of a room. And suddenly here she was on the big stage. I think America definitely gave her that great gift that it allowed her to express herself as an artist. And boy, does she do it. She still does it. When she walks on that stage, she commands the audience.
The outstanding quality is hard to pick because she has a personality on stage that's very likable. She has rhythm. She has a super voice, amazing voice, and she has a really high range, which is really, you know, important too as a singer. And she knows how to pick good musicians to work around her. She knows how to make it work for her from that perspective as well. And I think that's important. And, you know, I think she's, when she befriends people, she becomes a solid friend, a good friend, and is very loyal. So I think that's an important thing when you're on the road as well.
When she's singing, she's the focal point and she's the focus of the room. Should be your focus. She's one of a kind. She's one of a kind.
As a child, Maura never dreamed of pursuing a career as a full-time singer, let alone appearing in a film. In 2002, she found herself unexpectedly cast as a street singer in Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York.
On my challenge, we have met at this chosen ground to settle for good and all. Who holds sway over the 5 points? Us natives or the foreign hordes?
Yeah! Maura found herself alongside Leonardo DiCaprio, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Cameron Diaz. This opportunity was beyond her wildest imagination.
And I was at a fundraiser out in Las Vegas. And when I woke up at 7 o'clock or something like that, there was a pinging light on my phone to say that there was a message. And it was from my husband to say that Martin Scorsese wants you to go to Italy tomorrow. And I thought he was joking. So I called up. He said, no, they want you to go to Italy tomorrow. And I was thinking, why do they want me? Sure, couldn't they have anybody? And why am I coming from America when they could have gotten so many equally and better singers of you know, of Irishy stuff than me? But I got asked to go. And I did. And I got 4 trips to Italy. And I'm in it for like 2 seconds. It was interesting because I'd never been on a movie set. And I chatted for... Well, being the way I am, I had a disagreement with him about a particular line or word in the song. I said, no Irish person would ever say that. And so when I went to record it, I recorded both versions, the one he wanted and the one I wanted, and he chose the one he wanted. But, he chatted with me. He was very friendly. And I was walking through from one of the offices to where we were billeted, I suppose, you know, for the day, because there's a lot of waiting around. And this man said to me, who are you? And I said, who are you? He said, I'm the producer. So we got on great after that.
Maura's voice has been described as hauntingly beautiful and captivating. She possesses a rich and soulful quality that effortlessly conveys depth, emotion, and sincerity. Her vocal tone is warm and resonant, with a versatility that allows her to excel in a range of musical styles, from folk and traditional to contemporary and pop. Overall, listening to Maura O'Connell sing is a truly unforgettable experience that leaves a lasting impression on the listener.
She is as good as anybody right now, and she has kept her voice. I recently in Nashville, we did a tribute to John Prine, and she was part of that. And I was listening to her sing that night, and her voice was still just as full and true as it has ever been. She hasn't lost any of it.
Maura's right up there with everybody else that has recorded, and better than most, in that, she, as I said earlier, this X factor that she has, the soul that she that she has, the way she sings from right from the bottom of her heart, her Irish character, her Clare character, you know, her background as well. Her mum was a singer.
Oh, Maura's one of the great singers of all time. I think she's got a completely unique way of singing and presenting herself. And yeah, you can't beat Maura O'Connell.
I think she is unique as a performer. She got a unique voice. I think she is a huge voice in the development of our music, where she has taken her roots and brought it into American music, and her voice, her lilt. I think that affects people who listen to her, and there's no doubt she has given that to younger singers, and you hear younger singers pointing to Maura, not just Irish singers, American singers, and she is very inclusive, and I think she has made an incredible mark on our music landscape.
I love her. She's part of my world, you know, and part of my wife Jill. And she feels the same way. She goes to lunch with Maura, you know, all the time, and you know, but still, even in that situation, even in that setting, Maura's holding court, you know.
Maura's career has been filled with countless precious moments and invaluable experiences, leaving her with a treasure trove of cherished memories. Throughout it all, one person always holds a special place in her heart, the late John Prine. The iconic songwriter passed away a number of years ago.
I went out on tour with him many times, and we always had great times. And you know, he still does have a house up in Kinvara, and we always vacation up around that area. And so John and I would arrange a session in Mary Green's, and we try and keep it as quiet as possible. You know, at the age of cell phones, within 5 minutes the place would be jammed, but you know, we'd get a couple of the locals to play, and it was always great fun. And he came to our house many times, and I think our last picture of him was like the New Year's Eve before he died. And my husband Mac, he and a group of friends went fishing twice a year on a lake in Arkansas that he used to go with his brother when he was a kid. And he said his first gig he ever did was when he was 13 in Mountain View. So he had a great love for the place. So they went after he died, and it still makes me cry a little bit. And they had some of his ashes and they put them in the river. And one of the wives of one of the friends that they knew from up there gave them roses to put on in the water, and the roses followed them all the way down until they got to where they used to go and stay. Yeah.
Maura's remarkable career has truly touched the hearts of fans around the world, bringing joy and creating unforgettable moments for so many. Beginning her journey in the humble surroundings of Costello's fish shop, she has since elevated her craft to grace some of the most prestigious stages across the globe. Maura's path has been adorned with extraordinary achievements, cherished memories, and deeply heartfelt connections with fans who have been moved by her music and performances. While she now resides in Nashville, her heart remains intertwined with the beauty and spirit of County Clare.
When she comes to Clare, she loves to go to New Quay and Clahan and Lahinch and anywhere by the sea.
I adore it, every inch of it. When we were growing up, we always went west to Lahinch and Clahan. We had a distant relative out in Clahan we used to visit, and we had the place to ourselves because the locals didn't really go to the shore, really. And the only other the people from Ennis that went there were the Mulqueens, the bakery Mulqueens, and because we could see their blue van there on a Sunday. Gradually over time, and I think it was because I went to visit John and Fiona, they had rented a house up in New Quay, and I, you know, the Burren is such a magical place that any time we've come home, for the most part, we've stayed up there, rented a house up there, and you know, feel very comfortable there, and it's great walking. But we've also, I love East Clare, you know, because it's so different. And I, you know, we brought Mac and Jesse all around, like down around by Carrigaholt and Loophead and all those places. There isn't an inch of it that I don't love. You know, it's just Well, it's my heart, you know. As I say, I go to the burn to visit my soul. I love to sing Western Highway. As I said, I've never not sung it. And of course, and I really adore the Shades as well, you know. But it became then, in essence, about County Clare. And it's a love song for me about the county. And, you know, the Shades of Gloria is a beautiful line. Can you hear that distant sound coming down the West Clare Railway and running with the Shades of Gloria? You know, it's just beautiful. It's poetry. I never set out to become a professional musician. I've been hugely lucky. But the luck came from the talent that came from my mother and father and the house that we grew up in.
I am going to the country, going down that verdant lane, with nothing but a whistle in my hand and a pocket full of rain. Can you hear that distant sound coming down the West Clare Railway, running with the Shade of Glory?
From Ennis to Nashville has been recorded and produced by Pádraig Flaherty. A sincere thank you to Maura O'Connell. Thanks also to Anya Duran, Bela Fleck, Charlie McGettigan, Eleanor McAvoy, Frankie Gavin, Jerry Douglas, Jim Rooney, Mary Black, Morris Cassidy, Mike Hanrahan, PJ Curtis, Ronna Rubin. This documentary, From Ennis to Nashville, has been funded by Commission na Man with the television license fee.